I'm in the room 4:30, so it is on the third floor, I believe. Yes. Okay. So need this room.
For the few people are in the.
Yeah.
Christmas room.
Yes.
After the reception.
Yes. So I would like to thank organizers for giving me opportunity to give this talk and to keep me busy for some time preparing my notes. A bit to last moment, but well, sometimes it's good to have a deadline. So the title is Introduction to the Real Analytic Geometry of this lecture, and in fact there will be a third part which is essentially Introduction to Complex Analytic Geometry, or to complex variables. This will take maybe two or three lectures. The second part, which is really about the real case, will be the last two. And so the lecture notes, they concern, in fact, this complex part. And the real part, I think we can put on web this paper, on which is the base for the for will be base of this talk. Okay, so this is how it is organized. So the first lecture is completely classical, and there is, I believe, nothing really original which I would like to present. Second part, perhaps to some extent, is a bit original, but this is essentially a standard 19th century mathematics, one would say. Okay, so I will start with defining summability of families which are not finite in general. So let E will be a normed vector space. Say well, finite dimension, but it is not really important. It may be also Banach space. And suppose that we are given this vector space is over the field K, which is real or complex. Suppose we are given a family of vectors x alpha are the vectors in E, which is the set of, and this is, say, is A. So this is a family which is a priori even uncountable. So we will say that this family is summable, if and only if there exists an element in our vector space with the following property. For any epsilon, there exists a finite set, say F epsilon, such that if we take any other finite set which contains F epsilon, then the distance between X and this finite sum, but alpha taken from F, is less than epsilon. Okay, so this is somehow maybe a bit more modern definition of summability. What is essential here? That in fact, this definition gives more or less immediately as an exercise the following fact. that first this this family is summable. If and only if the family of norms is summable. This is not completely, not completely trivial. And the last condition is much easier to express, because this time we are in R plus. So saying that this family is summable means that the supremum over the finite sums this supremum is simply bounded. Okay, so this is the way to express this kind of convergence of infinite sum. Well, you can also prove that, for instance, if the family is summable, then the set of indices must be actually countable. Okay. So what can be said also that this summability is in fact associative. So you can make a package, and if each package is summable, then you sum on each package, and you obtain new family, and in this family should be also summable. One can also say that we have a kind of family of functions. So if you have a let's say Z Z F alpha is this time, instead of taking vectors, we take a function from Z to E. So we say that this is summable if and only if for each z that f alpha this family is summable, and is summable uniformly. If and only if for each z this family of vectors is summable, and this f epsilon can be chosen independently of z. Okay, so this is kind of uniform convergence. So now I would like to go to the more concrete situation, when we will consider this power series. So for power series, let me recall first definitions and notation, in fact. So we will take Z, which is an element of Kn, now for nu, which is multi-index, we define z power nu as a z1 nu1 product zn nun. We define, we can take Euclidean norm of it on this Kn, so this is standard and what I would like to define is we want to define also this combinatorial stuff. So nu factorial is the product of factorials of Okay. And finally, perhaps I will say here, we would like to define polydis. So for given point A in Kn and R an element of this power, so we define P A R, it is the set of elements on the Z from Kn such that J minus IJ is less than RJ. So this is a polydisk. In fact, polydisk is a name which is rather more appropriate for the complex case, because in the complex case this is a product of disks of radius of polyradius R and center A. So of course this polydisk, they form a basis of neighborhood in the standard topology defined by this this norm. Okay. So we have the following basic observation is that if we take an element theta, which is an of our Kn, such that the absolute the modules are less than one, then the family of theta nu in N is actually summable, and the sum is can be explicitly computed. So okay. So this is kind of generalization of standard geometric series, and as you know, all the theory of geometric of power series in one variable, it is based on estimates in comparison with geometric series, and this is will be the fact the case in our situation. So now I would like to state the classical result, very useful, is the Abel lemma. So so what does it say? So suppose that we are given a family of vectors in coefficients which will be complex in general, nu from Rn. So in other way, in other words, we may say that a power series is given without precising what means power series. Power series is exactly the collection of coefficients. So if this power series converges for if this series this is a numerical series generalized is summable for some B which is say coordinates, but all we want all of them to be non-zero. Then our power series or our family is summable. This is not the exactly the same. I assume that. I should put what I have written somehow. So, let us say like that. Assume that there exists a. So this is B, which is C star, and C star power N, and M positive, such that we have this estimate, A nu B power U is less or equal than M. For all mu. Then our series is summable. In the poly disk centered at origin and the poly radius, which is the sequence of modules of B. Okay. So this is, I think, now the correct version of Abel's lemma. So the proof is just application of exercise one. Okay. Now, what is a consequence? Well, there are many consequences, of course, of Abel's lemma. Abel's lemma is somehow the starting point for developing this theory. And what I would like to do is to talk about poly radius associated to a power series. Okay, so let us fix a power series. And maybe not necessarily convergent, in fact, except zero. But what we can define for given z in C, we can we can define gamma z in the following way. So this is a limit superior of the sums A nu G power nu nu, the length of nu equal L, and this we take to the power 1 over L. Okay? Where L goes to infinity. So this is a positive number or infinity. And we may observe that if this family, if this this family is summable, then using standard Cauchy rule, we can deduce that gamma z must be less than equal 1. Okay. But on the other hand, we may observe also the following. So this is one observation. The second is that if this family if gamma z is less than zero, then this family converges. So it is summable. Okay. And so, and as a consequence, we may say the following. We have a corollary. That the series A nu, is it nu, is summable in polydisk if and only if gamma is less than 1 in the polydisk. So now, thanks to this observation, we can define, we can associate to a given power series a maximal polydisk on which this gamma is less than 1. Okay. And so this will be called maximal polydisk after, maybe I should put polydisk phi 0 r on which gamma is less than 1, and now this R is the polyradius of convergence. Of our power series. Okay. So this is the analogy with the univariate case. So why I am insisting on it? Because this will be useful when taking derivatives of a power series. So assume that we have a power series that which I will this time denote by F. Okay, and we fix some k between 1 and n. So we can define another power series which is denoted as partial derivative with respect to z in the standard way. I hope I'm correct. So it will be nu k So this is operation on a formal power series. And now we can relate it to this convergence.
Well, you're missing your coefficient, A mu.
Yes, so this is a... Yeah, thank you. Now, the what is useful is the following observation. Exercise. So if F is summable in a polydisk of multiradius R, then this partial derivative is also summable in the same polydisk. Okay. So this is purely application of this formula for gamma and the corollary, because you should use this this fact that when you take limit of L power 1 over L minus 1, and when L goes to infinity, then this is 1. Okay. Okay, so now we can define an analytic function in several variables. Let U be open in Kn. C a point in U, and F a function from U to K. So we say that F is analytic at C if and only if there exists a power series. This time it will be Z minus C power nu, which is will be the Taylor series of F at C, of the positive polyradius of convergence, maybe I say like that, summable in P on P0 R, where R, which are all positive, such that we can write as Z is the sum of the of this series. This is must be true in the whole part in this. In this polydisk. Of course, the series can be converging in a bigger power disk than we can put inside the U. But of course, then so you should shrink this power disk. And F is analytic. Is analytic if it is analytic at any point, any C in U. And finally, we'll say that it is In the case when we have k equals c, we say holomorphic rather. So if k is a c, we shall use the name holomorphic. Okay. So this is the crucial definition. So what is important that we can, in the neighborhood of a point, we can develop in a power series our function. And now, as in this, in the one variable case, so in the one variable case, what is important? What is crucial in the complex situation, that in fact we can relate the fact that we can expand in the power series, we can relate it to the existence of complex derivatives. Yeah, so this is, and all the rest of the talk will be somehow this relation to the complex derivation. And as a consequence, we can quite easily obtain important results on analytic maps quite quickly somehow. So you should not be afraid that the fact that you have to work with power series makes things really very difficult. Okay. So the first observation is that each analytic function is actually C infinity, of the class infinity. So proposition. F analytic in U implies that F is C infinity differentiable, C infinity K differentiable on U. So just to that indication of the proof, so this is classical if we have one variable, so we should go through this computation in one variable, and now we can use this observation that about the derivative. So this exercise also that when we know that f is analytic, so it can be expanded in the power series, then this partial derivative against converges in the same poly disk, and finally you should use this relation between coefficients and partial derivatives. Okay. So. So this this fact enables us to state now this fundamental property of analytic functions. So this is theorem. Analytic continuation principle, which I state in the following way. Let U in Kn be open and connected F column analytic function, and assume that at one point the power series is exactly vanishing. So if there exists a point C nu such that all partial derivatives at that point are zero, then F is identically zero in U. Okay? So this is the fundamental fact about analytic functions. So if you know if you know power series at one point, then on all the connected set, somehow you know the function. Of course, what means you know? You know that this is some always transcendental operation to compute it in another point. But in the transcendental way, the sense it is determined by this power series by its Taylor series at what point. So in particular, if F is zero on a subset V of U and the interior of this V is non-empty, then we can say that the function is identically zero. So how to prove this? So we can use one dimensional case. The one dimensional case is not completely trivial, the proof. It needs some kind of a bit subtle argument. So in fact, I think it's more difficult than this several variable case. And I believe in general, one can say that this, what I'm talking about, is much easier in the case in the several variables than one variable. So we simply find some tricks to extend things in many variables. But essential difficulty is in one variable. Also, I have chosen this approach classical because I believe that complex analysis is a so beautiful subject. I don't know if it is very much popular now in the United States or in America, but it deserves to be presented from time to time. Okay, so coming back to this proof, simply the hint is that when you have an open set connected, say, you take two points, let's say this is a point C, and this is another point Z, so you follow a path which is piecewise parallel to the axis. Say this is one, this is two. So on each axis, on each interval, you apply one dimensional result. And since our open set is connected, so you can always find a path between these two given points, which is in that form. So what is some kind of observation which is very important, because we will study next analytic sets. Analytic sets are the zeros of analytic functions. So if U is connected, F analytic, but not constant, then the interior of the zero set of F is empty. Okay, so this is an immediate consequence of this statement. So this, okay, so there was nothing specific, in fact, in many variables up to now. And now the more interesting part is separate analysis. So I will state so we have Osgood's lemma. So Osgood's lemma states the following. When we have U open in Kn, F a function to K assume that F is analytic in each variable Z j. And locally and locally bounded. Then F is analytic. Osgood's lemma is not true in the real case. So we should take complex numbers. So then we should say rather holomorphic, yes? Then it is holomorphic. In U. And in fact, this assumption about local boundedness is not necessary. So this is superfluous. By Hartog theorem. Okay, so because I said Osgood's lemma, which is weaker but easier to prove somehow, and it is enough strong for our next application. So perhaps I will give line 3-4. I'll give an idea how to. We prove this Osgood's lemma using integral formulas. First, we state the lemma So we may assume, in the proof, we may assume the let's assume that U is a polycylinder, a polydisk. I don't know, this is in the English name, polydisc, or one you use also polycylinder, I think, yes? No? Or maybe French. I may mix up French and English. That's possible. Okay. So the proof of this Osgood's lemma is by induction on n, the number of variables. So of course, n1 is trivial, and first we state a lemma. So we assume that one variable lemma. So omega will be an open subset in C, and G and a function which is on omega times interval AB to C, which is bounded holomorphic in Z and continuous in T, this the second variable. Then when we compute this function H Z, which is given by this integral formula, kind of average, one can say, then this is a holomorphic in omega. Well, perhaps I will not prove this lemma, but because it takes some time, I'm not very quick. So look on this lecture notes. I would like to stress that these assumptions are a bit weak, because we don't assume G to be continuous, in fact, in two variables. We assume it is holomorphic in one variable and continuous in another. So usually standard error of undergraduate student is that when they see continuity in each variable separately, they consider that function is continuous. So here, in fact, we prove using a Cauchy formula that first you must prove that G is actually uniformly continuous with respect to Z. And now when you have uniform continuity with one variable and continuity with another variable, then this is classical to deduce that the function is continuous in both variables. When we have both continuity in both variables, we expand this analytic holomorphic function using Cauchy formula, and so also in integral form, and we can use Fubini theorem to change the order of integration. So this is the way how it is proved, this lemma. And now we can achieve the proof of this Osgood's theorem in the following way. We expand our function because we have analyticity with respect to the last variable in particular. So we expand it in this way. So this is expansion in one variable, in variable Zn. And so here, Z prime are the first n minus one variables. And now, we can use Cauchy formula to compute this coefficient. So how can we compute this coefficient? So this function, this coefficient, is in fact given by this integral formula. So we may apply lemma, the lemma. So the indices are not with. This is should be. Yes, thank you. Yes. So, by the lemma, AL prime, all these functions are holomorphic in each variable separately. So by induction in hypothesis, we conclude that all AL prime AL are holomorphic. But so now we can come back to this expansion. So we can replace each function by its Taylor expansion, and we obtain some formal formal power. And it is now enough to check that it is it will give exactly the our function f. So expand each AL and you obtain a Taylor series. F at some point C. Okay. So this is somehow the idea of the proof of the this was good. Of course, this Osgood lemma is not true in the real case. So what I was trying to convince you in the beginning. So, but it was good because you see that this is a deep difference in the real case and complex. So you have example of function which you probably have seen many times before. For instance, this one, and 0 at 0, it's analytic in each variable, real analytic. Continuous but not C1 at origin. Okay, so this Osgood lemma is false in the real case. So I think just 1 minute to, well, because I think this will, so once we have this Osgood lemma, in fact, what are the consequences of the Osgood lemma? Consequences that to study analytic function, or to check that a function is analytic, holomorphic more precisely, it's enough to look on this analysis with respect to each variable separately. Okay? But analysis in each variable separately, it is complex the derivation, which is equivalent to Cauchy-Riemann equation. So somehow we may say that if we have a function which is defined on a subset of Cn, which is real differentiable, which verifies the Cauchy-Riemann equations, then F is holomorphic. And so this is useful when you want to show, for instance, the inverse mapping theorem or implicit function theorem. They are equivalent. So in the sense that when we want to show that the inverse mapping theorem for analytic holomorphic functions, we use real version of this theorem, and now we only check that since differentials are complex linear maps. So the inverse will be again complex linear, and the complex linearity is equivalent to Cauchy-Riemann equations, or we will check that these Cauchy-Riemann equations are satisfied for the inverse, and we deduce, for instance, the inverse mapping theorem, the same for implicit function theorem. Of course, one can try to prove inverse mapping theorem directly, but then you need to make estimates. To show estimates for the Pauli radius of convergence of the inverse, and this is not trivial. This is somehow tedious, and this complex variables Cauchy formula allows us to obtain these results just by topological argument somehow. So this was the main issue in this lecture. Okay, excuse me for.
Any questions? Okay, well then, you have a great day. Up and out.